Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 International License. For more information, visit creativecommons.org. How many piano tuners are there in New York City? How much cheese is there in Delaware? And how can you find out? All this and more on this problem episode of Breaking Math. P9, give or take. I'm Sophia.
I'm Meryl.
And you're listening to Breaking Math. First, just a few plugs. The tensor poster, 24 by 36 inches mat, about tensors which are used in general relativity. You can buy that at our Facebook poster store at facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast. If you want to donate monthly, which we really appreciate, you'll get our episodes without ads and even have the outlines that we use for the show. $1 or more gets you that, and that's at patreon.com/breakingmath, and we really appreciate that. The tensor poster is also there as a prize for donating pi to the e-dollars, I believe. If you want to buy it directly from Facebook, though, it's $15.15 plus $4.50 shipping and handling for a total of $19.65. You can also find updates about the show there and on Twitter at BreakingMathPod, our website, BreakingMathPodcast.app, and you can email us at BreakingMathPodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, ideas, and corrections. Anyway, so Fermi problems, what are they?
So they're a way of using dimensional analysis to sort of get, you know, an estimate of, you know, certain problems, like how many piano tuners are there in New York.
Yeah, and these are problems that were made popular by Fermi during World War II. They would actually have competitions where people would try to get like something correct to within one digit within 10 seconds and all kinds of silly things like that. But Fermi, when the bomb went off, he dropped pieces of paper from his hands and he measured how far they fell from the top of his head. And using that, he got that the bomb at the Trinity site was 10 kilotons. And its actual value is 21 kilotons. But that's the kind of accuracy we're talking about here, right? Like within an order of magnitude.
Exactly. And another name for these, by the way, is back-of-the-envelope estimates.
Of course, just because they could be done on random scraps of paper. Napkin estimates, I believe, is also a term. There's all sorts of terms. But yeah, so how do we do the piano tuners there are in the New York City thing?
Well, first, we're going to start with, so how many people are there in New York City?
There's like, it depends on what you're talking about, the regular city or the metropolitan area, but we're going to say 10 million people, roughly.
Okay, it's definitely in that order of magnitude.
Yeah, because it's not a million people, because it's not some burg, and it's not 100 million people, because cities like that are still fictional.
So how many pianos per person do you think there are?
Because most pianos are probably in houses, given the fact that like concerts and stuff like that have a piano that can be used over and over again. I'd say maybe one piano to every 100 people, because I've only been in a couple houses that have pianos in them.
Okay, so that means that with 10 million people, there's about 100,000 people in New York City who have pianos.
Yeah, so there's 100,000 people who need pianos, who have pianos, which is like 100,000 pianos that need tuning. So now we're getting somewhere, right? We know how many pianos roughly need tuning. So how frequently are they going to be tuned?
Probably once every year to 5 years.
Yeah, so let's round to 2.5 years. And what's 100,000 pianos divided by 2.5 years per tuning?
So that would be 40,000 tunings a year.
Yeah, 40,000 tunings. a year because you need one tuning per piano. Let's say somebody needs to make a living tuning, right?
Yeah.
They probably need to work 5 days a week for roughly 50 weeks or do about, let's say, 250 tunings per year, roughly. Because I know that it takes a while to tune a piano. So what's 40,000 divided by 250?
So that's about 160 is what we could guess is how many piano tuners are in New York City.
Yeah, and of course that's either a little high or a little low. And the thing is, you might have noticed that we made a bunch of steps, but for a reason that we'll tell you later, the amount of steps that we take is not does not actually make our guess that much worse because of something called random walks and because of the concept of logarithms. But we'll talk about that later. I took on to myself to look up how many piano tuners there were in New York City, and I got a listing for about 20 businesses. A lot of them were single people who did it. A few of them were places that have that were known as piano tuning, quote unquote, institutions. So it looks like there's about 50 piano tuners in New York City, which means that we're not that far off. It also turns out that if you start calling piano tuners in New York as soon as they open up, you might get hung up on a couple of times. This is how I spent my morning. And we haven't prepared any more back of the envelope estimations for the show, but we're going to do some on the show just because they're fun to do and to show you how impromptu these can be done. So, I don't know. Let's think of another one. Do you want to think of this next one, Meryl?
Let's think about how many litter boxes are there in, let's say, Austin, Texas.
All right, Austin, Texas. I know that's a biggish city, but not that big. Yeah. So let's say 2 million people live there.
Yeah, closer to 1 million, I would say.
Yeah, so let's start with 1 million since if we have information, let's use it, obviously. So let's say 1 million people. I'd say roughly 1 in 10 people probably own a cat.
Sounds fair enough.
All right, so you have 1 million people divided by 10 per people per ollie per every cat. That's probably 100,000 cats. And there's probably one litter box per cat. So somewhere around 100,000 litter boxes in Austin.
Right, and that's assuming we have one litter box for a household with at least one cat.
Yeah, and I know vets recommend that you have as many litter boxes as you have cats plus one, but I know not everybody follows that. All right, awesome. Let's think of another one, quick.
So here's one. How much electricity, and we'll say in kilowatt hours, is used in the city of Moscow?
Right, so let's see. You have electricity used by houses, and you have a certain amount of electricity used per person in houses, and we have electricity from industry, right? So let's figure out the houses first. Let me think. Okay, so there's probably about 5 million people in Moscow, something like that, I'm guessing. I don't have the information. I'm going to say 5 million people.
Okay, let's just go with that guess.
All right, so 5 million people in Moscow. Let's see. All right, so let's say that the amount of electricity that you use in a house is the same as, 10 60-watt bulbs on 24 hours a day. Per person, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, we'll roll with it.
All right, so let's see, let's say industrially, just knowing how much industry takes up of electricity and stuff, let's just multiply that by 5. So for each person, let's say that they consume an average of a 50 60-watt bulbs at any given time, which is the same thing as a 3-kilowatt bulb being on 24 hours a day. 3-kilowatt, so that times 24, that is... All right, so we have 70 kilowatt hours per person per day times 5 million people, and 1 million times 1,000 is 1 billion, so we're using gigawatts. So that'd be about 350 gigawatt, roughly. And I decided to look up how many people about the electricity consumption in Russia. And the electricity consumption of the entire country of Russia is about 145 gigawatts per day. And let's see, how many people live in Moscow? And a little less than a tenth of the population lives there. So we're a little high by a factor of about 10, right?
Yeah.
But we weren't that far off, especially from the little tiny bit of data that we had.
Yeah, and I just made that problem up and we didn't Google anything before.
Yeah, and it's just it shows really the value of this sort of reasoning. And we'll come back to a few more of these problems. But before we go on with these, we're going to justify the reason why we can do this. And you could either sit through the explanation or you could fast forward a little bit. Stay tuned.
So to understand the reasoning behind Fermi estimates, we're just going to talk a little bit about addition, multiplication, and logarithms.
All right, so this gets you some intuition, dear audience. I'm a writer from the 19th century. So let's start with the number one. If I multiply that number by 10, I'll have 10, right?
Yeah.
Which has 1 0. And the number, so we started with no zeros, and now we have 1 0. So that we can't do much with just that. But if I multiply by 1,000, which has 3 zeros, right? We'll get 10,000, which has 4 zeros, and 4 is 3 plus 1. And if I multiplied that again by a number with 5 zeros, we would get a number with 5 plus 4 equals 9 zeros, right?
Yeah. And so there's actually a name for the number of zeros that, you know, a number has. And we call that, or at least the number of digits, and we call that the order of magnitude.
Yeah. And that's what it means when we say that back of the envelope estimates are roughly order of magnitude estimates, because it turns out that that the number 10 is also the number of fingers that we have, but it's also around how useful an estimate can be if it's just a really broad estimate. And so you notice that obviously multiplication and addition seem to be related by, you know, adding zeros and subtracting zeros by dividing. And of course, what is this relation between addition and multiplication? How can it be typified? Let's give it a concrete example. 4 is 2 squared, right? And 16 is 2 to the 4th, right?
Yeah.
And 4 times 16 is 64, which turns out to be 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, or 2 to the 6th. And 6 is 2 plus 4, right?
Sounds right.
Now, let's say we want to go backwards, right? We can use what we call logarithms. So logarithms answer the question... For like, let's say we have two numbers, right? Let's say we have the number 10 and we have the number 1,000. And we want to know, to what power do we raise 10 to get 1,000? We know the answer is 3. But if we wanted to write this down mathematically, we would say log base 10, which is just L-O-G with little 10 next to the G, a little small 10 in the subscript. And then next to that, you would just write 1,000. So that says log 10 of 1,000, and then that equals 3, right?
Right.
So what would be log base 2 of 1,000?
So let's start with, let's take 2 to the 9th. That's 512. 2 to the 10th then is 1,024. So what we get then is that, so 2 to the 10th is really close to 1,000. That means that log 2 of 1,000 is probably really close to 10.
Yeah, and the actual answer is 9.96. And it's actually sometimes used in back of the envelope estimations. We won't show exactly, that could be maybe a take-home problem. But using the fact that log base 2 of 10 is roughly 3 and a third, you could do a lot of cool stuff with that. And so let's put this all together. Logarithms also have a relationship between addition and multiplication. And that relationship is log base A of B times C is equal to log base A of B plus log base A of C. So when you multiply the numbers that you're taking the arguments of, all you do is add the numbers together. And that's how slide rules work, right? You just keep multiplying numbers, and like if I keep multiplying by 2 on a slide rule, I keep going down the slide rule the same distance, but the numbers will keep doubling and doubling because the numbers keep getting smaller and smaller, right?
Right.
You listen to Breaking Math, which probably means you're a big nerd, and you're in good company. We're all big nerds here at Breaking Math, and I want to talk to you about Brilliant. Brilliant is a one-stop shop for math and science. They have everything from lectures on number theory to mind-expanding puzzles and exercises. And how do you learn this, you might ask? Through both presented information and problems to solve. After all, you learn best by actively using your knowledge. This week, we want to feature a wonderful course on machine learning. It is one of many courses in data science available on Brilliant. So what are you waiting for? Sign up at brilliant.org/breakingmath. The first 250 listeners get 20% off the annual subscription. That's brilliant.org/breakingmath.
Hey, Breaking Math fans. First, I want to thank you for listening. I have an important message for everyone. You can start your own podcast right now with Anchor. Anchor lets you create and distribute your own podcast. Just get an idea, record, and upload. It's just that easy. Anyone can do it. I'm on my way to accomplishing my dream, and you can too. Just get on your device's app store and download Anchor. It contains everything you need to make a podcast. With Anchor, you can put your podcast on all the big platforms. Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, Amazon, and more. Reach the whole world with Anchor. Best of all, Anchor is free. You have nothing to lose with a free platform. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Now we're going to be talking a little bit about random walks. So simply put, a random walk is like, let's say you start at a certain position and you flip a coin. If the coin flips to heads, you walk a foot forward. If it flips to tails, you walk 1 foot backward. Now, if you keep doing that over and over again, you're going to be describing a random walk. And random walks describe everything from stock markets to Brownian motion, which is like if you put pollen particles on top of water so that they float on top, and you look at them under a microscope, you'll see that they diffuse out without any extra energy, and that is the Brownian motion. But to talk about random walks, we're going to have to talk about the components of random walks, which are called random variables. So random variables are, simply put, variables with a range of outcomes. What are some examples of this? Obviously, coin flip and die rolls, dart throws, coordinates. What else? The weight of a random person.
If you spin a spinner for a board game, what color it'll land on?
Yeah, that's another random variable. Yeah, there's all sorts of random variables. And random variables happen when you have a lack of information about something, which is kind of appropriate for the episode that we're doing, right?
Right, because you don't... The whole point of random variables is that you don't know what the result is going to be till it happens.
Yeah, and the whole point, as well as of Fermi estimations, is that we don't know all this stuff. I mean, we know a certain amount, but quantifying how much ignorance we have is important, especially to convince ourselves that the error doesn't just stack up, right? Because let's say that we're off by a factor of 2 each time, and we just kept getting worse and worse estimations. Then within 5 steps, we'd be already at 32 times less than or more than the value. You'd just keep growing exponentially, basically. Random variables have a few properties. One of those is the expected value. So that's kind of like the average outcome of a random variable. So the expected value of a die would be what, Meryl?
So we want to average together all the numbers on a die. So to do that, we add them up. So 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6. And that adds up to...
6 times 3 plus 3, which is 21.
Right. And then we want to divide that by 6.
Yeah, so we get 21 sixths or 7 halves.
So 3.5.
Yeah, which makes sense. Because, like, you know, the lowest one is 1 and the highest one is 6. So, of course, going to be somewhere in the middle there. What's interesting, too, is that if you flip 2 dice, the most common number that you're going to land on is 7, which is also the average outcome as well. And that's the expected value as well in that situation. And it turns out that if you add random variables, you add their expected values together. Now we're going to talk about another metric associated with random variables called standard deviation. Standard deviation is a measure of how widely spread a random variable is. If a random variable has a standard deviation of 0, then it's completely deterministic. And it is the average, basically, the square root of the average of how far each outcome is from the average outcome. So, but before we talk about that, we're going to talk about bell curves, right? Do you want us to talk about what a bell curve is really quick?
So if we have a lot of random variables that we're putting together, then a lot of the times our probabilities become this distribution that's called a bell curve or a normal distribution.
Yeah, and that's found in a lot of kind of like evenly distributed data. And one thing is a height. So the European female mean height was around 5 foot 5.4 inches or 164.7 centimeters with a standard deviation of 2.78 inches or 7.07 centimeters. So what can we do with this information?
So we could find out however many European women are within a certain range of height.
Yeah, and there's formulas that you could plug into this, like the error function and stuff like that. to get this. But one handy rule is the 68-95-99.7 rule.
And so what that means, so 68% of a population or a number of samples are going to be within one standard deviation of our average, 95% within two standard deviations, and 99.7 within three.
Yeah, and so three standard deviations in this situation would be about 21.21 centimeters. And so if we add and subtract that from the mean height of 164.7 centimeters, we get a height anywhere between 157 and 171 centimeters, or 4 foot 9 inches and 6 foot 1.8 inches. And that range contains 99.7% of European women. And you could also you divide that by two. So not, you could say that 99.85% of women are less than 6 foot 1.8 inches tall, which is kind of interesting. So how do we calculate the standard deviation?
The standard deviation is the square root of the average of how far the outcomes are from the average outcome. Squared.
Yeah, and I know that sometimes you divide by, instead of divide, you know how like in an average you divide by n? I know that sometimes with the standard deviation you divide by n minus 1, but we're not going to be messing with that. That's called the adjusted standard deviation, and it happens because of degrees of freedom. Basically, when you average out a certain number of samples, you're always going to get a zero term, so you're going to calculate the standard deviation to be a little bit too low. But we're going to ignore that for the time being. It's just something good to know so that you don't take this definition as the absolute one in all circumstances. So what's the standard deviation from average die roll?
So we know that every outcome is going to be some distance from 7/2 or 3.5.
Yeah, which is what our expected value from earlier.
And so what we're going to do is, so it's going to be 1/6 times each of those outcomes minus 7/2 squared, and then all under a square root.
Yeah, which is comes out to the square root of 35/12, or roughly 1.7. And the standard deviation of a random variable that's uniformly distributed between negative 1 and 1 is the square root of 1/3. And a uniform distribution just means kind of like the wheel of fortune, or like something like that, where you have a whole range of something between like 0 and 1, right? 0 and 1 turn of the wheel of fortune.
Yeah, so every outcome is equally likely.
And of course, you could do arithmetic with random variables. So if you multiply two random variables with their certain variances, you multiply their variances, which also means you multiply their standard deviations, right?
Right.
And the expected value of this new random variable is the product of those expected values too. It works somewhat with addition, but you also have to add in twice the covariance, so we're not going to be messing with that. And with Fermi estimates, we don't usually throw in addition unless we're doing it as part of something bigger, and we're usually pretty sure about something if we throw in addition, right? Like, I mean, remember the Moscow problem? We had to throw in addition for the for industry, but that was only, it was only really multiplying something by a guess, right?
Right.
So a random walk is the sum of an output of a bunch of random variables. So it's like we said earlier, flipping a coin repeatedly and going to forward 1 foot if it's heads and going backward if it's tails, or Brownian motion. Because Brownian motion is the sum of all the momentum changes that you get from particles, like gas particles hit, or like water particles hitting an object. That's why tiny objects are affected by Brownian motion, but the bigger the object, it's less affected. So you might be wondering, how far will we get with a random walk? So it turns out, and this is something that dates back to Einstein's paper on pollen on the surface of water. The stuff starts spreading out immediately, but then it slows down its spread as everything goes randomly. And it turns out that the standard deviation basically increases with the square root of time, with Brownian motion, or with the square root of how many trials, you know?
Yeah. So what I'm getting at is that standard deviation is a bit more resistant to adding different random steps together.
Yeah, it's almost like they correct each other, but they don't. It's weird. And it's also kind of weird too, because the expected value of the sum of the trials is zero, because any, it's equally likely to be on either side, but the expected value of the square of the sum is n. We might do a whole episode on that. But the takeaway is that with a random walk, it'll be harder and harder to expect further and further distances over time, in proportion to the square root of n. After 1 second, you might expect a certain proportion within a certain distance. After 4 seconds, you increase the distance by one unit of distance. After 5 more seconds, which is 9, you just go one more unit and so forth. So we now know that random walks can only get so far over so much time. And Fermi approximations have a certain standard deviation as well. And we know about logarithms. So how can we put those all together?
So at the end of the day, a Fermi approximation is a random walk.
Yeah, and you might wonder, like, how is that? Well, since we multiply and divide each time and we're over and underestimating, basically what we're doing is we're adding the logarithm of what we're adding and dividing. Because remember, on a slide rule, multiplying and dividing are just moving left and right by the amount that you're multiplying and dividing by on the rule. And so it's basically a random walk, right, on a slide rule. And so that means that after n multiplications, let's say we're off by a factor of at most 2 each time. So we're either half under or half over. Then we expect with a standard deviation that corresponds to square root of n times the average standard deviation. And remember, our standard deviation here is us getting a value between 1/2 and 2. So that means after 9 steps, what's the square root of 9?
3.
3. And since we're off by a factor of 2 each time, we raise 2 to the power of 3, or 8. So we're within roughly 1/8 to 8 times the true value with the same amount of confidence that we were within 1/2 to 2 times the value. And that's after 9 whole steps. After 20 steps, our approximation is good to basically 2 orders of magnitude, or basically 1/22, which is 2 digits, you know.
So even if we're less accurate then, so say we're within a factor of 3, so those numbers would be 27 and 136.
Yeah, it's so weird.
That's the amazing thing about this, is that even though, for the most part, we're totally guessing numbers, well, we're taking an educated guess, but at the end of the day, we get something that looks like a reasonable estimate.
Yeah, which is kind of insane, but now be the annoying person at parties who goes around asking, hey, how many ice cubes are there in Memphis? How many ice cubes are there in Memphis? Let's see.
So, how big of a city is Memphis?
I think it's like a bit, I mean, rock and roll comes from there, so I assume it's like a couple million at least.
Yeah, let's go with 1 million.
All right.
So it's about 1 million. How many ice cubes do you think a typical person will use in a day?
I'd say, let's say 10 ice cubes, because some people really like their sodas.
Okay, so 1 million people times 10 ice cubes is, the city goes through 10 million ice cubes a day. So if the city goes through 10 million ice cubes a day, then we just need to take a guess of how many more times of that do we need in order to satisfy the need and keep enough stored. So let's guess that there's 10 times as much of that. So we'll say that there's 100 million ice cubes in the city of Memphis.
Yep. And what is the weight of those ice cubes? I'll do this one. There are a few cubic centimeters of water. So let's say 10 grams. 10 grams times 100 million is 1 billion grams, which is 1 million kilograms, which is of ice, or about 1,000 tons of ice. All right, let's see. How much bug spray would it take to kill all the bugs in the Amazon?
Ooh, that's a good one. So how big do we want to say the Amazon is?
Well, let's see. Brazil is about the size of the Louisiana Purchase, which I know is 1 million square kilometers, give or take.
So let's say the Amazon is what, like 1/10 of Brazil's landmass?
Something like that.
Yeah. So 100,000 square kilometers?
Yeah, let's say that. Like 100,000 square kilometers, give or take, in the Amazon. Now, how many bugs, obviously, per square kilometer? And I guess we could think about that in terms of square meters. So let's do maybe bugs per square meter. We know that the Amazon is a rainforest, which means that it's not particularly rich in minerals, which means that it's not going to host a gigantic insect population, but a respectable one. So I'd say 1 per square meter or something, give or take wildly.
Yeah, I would have guessed maybe 10.
Yeah, let's say, okay, so let's take the average, the log average, and do 3.
Okay, so 3 bugs per square meter.
So if it's 3 bugs per square meter, then that is 3 million per square kilometer. So 3 million per square kilometer times 100,000 square kilometers is, let's see, that's 3 times 10 to the 6th times 1 times 10 to the 5th, which is 3 times 10 to the 11th or 300 billion bugs. All right, that's part one. So there's 300 billion bugs. So how much bug spray would it take to kill 300 billion bugs?
So I guess the way to think about it is, let's say that you just see one bug and you need to kill it. So let's just say that you have one bug and you want to spray it dead. So how much bug spray, like, do you think comes out of the can whenever you spray one bug?
If I take a drop of water, which is about a tenth of a cc, I just happen to know that, and I spread it around, it's probably about the same area as a bug spray.
Same volume, you mean?
Same volume as a spray of bug spray. Same kind of wetness, you know?
Okay. So we're saying like tenth of a milliliter for a single bug.
Yeah. So we have a tenth of a milliliter times what?
So a tenth of a milliliter times how many bugs did we say?
300 billion.
300 billion or million?
A billion. Because there's 100,000 square kilometers times 3 million bugs per square kilometer.
Okay. So it would take then, so 30 billion milliliters or 30 million liters of bug spray to kill off the entire bug population of the Amazon. And as a note to the listener, we do not condone killing off the entire insect population of the Amazon.
Yeah, save that for Mars. I don't know. But seriously, don't do that. Try to be environmentally conscious while writing letters to those who have more power than you. And also direct action. So yeah, that's for me approximations. What did you think of this? I know that you were slightly newer to these than I was.
Yeah, I am not a statistician. And in general, I'm not the biggest fan of stats, but I thought that this was at least fun.
Yeah, and it's fun being able to answer dumb questions like, how many rubber bands are there in Idaho? Which could be a take-home quiz. Another take-home quiz could be, how many batteries have ever been consumed since modern batteries have been around? How much money was spent in the 1930s in the United States? And let's see, what's a good one?
Or maybe, how many calories does America eat together on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, so I am Sophia.
I'm Meryl.
And this has been a Breaking Math Problem episode. Patreon would be great. Oh, you have a couple of new patrons, and thanks to them so much. We hope to get more because we want to be able to do some cool stuff for you, and that provides a reliable source of income. So thank you for everyone who is a patron.
I will give a shout out to the University of New Mexico Grad Workers Union. UNM works because we do.
Oh, and also our poster, facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast. Click on store.